and is seen back to the hotel. The manager's been waiting for us to finish. He says he can't afford for the room to be left empty. She laughed. Can you believe that? He's going to try to let it out again tonight. Holiday tomorrow, Josie said. He says he's full. The woman's assistant shone a black light around the bathroom, satisfied himself that he had taken the relevant prints, and started to pack away his brushes and powders. I'll have a report for you in a couple of days, the woman said. It'll be short. Thanks. Josie watched them as they loaded their equipment into the car. She noticed a small camera fixed to the underside of the ceiling of the veranda. She looked more carefully and saw that there were two of them, each pointing in opposite directions. She stood back and considered the arc that they would be able to cover. One of them was pointing almost directly at the door to the room. This case was so obvious that she didn't need a break to solve it, but the footage would be useful for the purposes of confirming what she already knew. The manager and his wife were watching at the edge of the crowd of ghouls who had gathered to observe the scene. She went over to them.
It is finished?
Finished, Josie said with a nod.
Is there anything else?
You said his name was Smith?
John Smith. He said he was from London.
How did he pay?
He booked online and paid cash.
Do you have his address?
No.
Anything else, officer?
The wife said.
We are very busy. We'd like to get back to work.
Josie pointed over to the cameras that she had seen.
Did those work?
Yes, Mr. Santos said. We have had problems in the past.
There were problems.
Mrs. Santos cut him off, presumably uncomfortable with discussing the prostitutes and pushers that Josie suspected were the reasons for the difficulties and the installation of the cameras.
I'd like to have a look at the footage.
Mrs. Santos sighed. Is that necessary? I thought it was obvious what had happened.
I think it is, but I like to be thorough.
Can you do it?
Mrs. Santos said to her husband, her tone clipped and impatient.
I'll have to set it up for you, the man replied. Can you come back tomorrow?
Josie had to come by the hotel on her way back to her mother's house in Alabang.
Get it ready tonight, she said. I'll be here at 8.
Logan watched. He had been listening to the police radio and had heard the report of the murder as it was called in. He had arrived at around the same time as the responding officer. She was a woman and, he noted to his satisfaction, she looked young and inexperienced. That was good. A small group of onlookers had gathered to gawp as Milton was hauled out of the room, taken to the police car and driven away. Logan had parked his rental at the other end of the lot. The sedan had tinted windows, and he knew that he would not be visible from the outside. He waited there for another hour, watching as the police officer went back and forth between the office and Milton's room. The girl was wheeled out of the room on a gurney and loaded onto the back of the mortuary wagon. Logan waited. The man and woman who owned the guest house came out of the office and hovered at the fringe of the onlookers. Logan was happy. Everything was as he wanted it to be. He put the car into drive and slowly drove away. Josie got into her car and set off for the station. She waited until she had merged into the heavy traffic and made a hands-free call to her mother.
Hello, Josie.
Hello, Mama. How is Angelo?
He's good.
What time did he wake?
An hour after you left. He was asking for you.
She drummed her fingers on the wheel. She knew that her mother meant well, that she was trying to say that Angelo missed her, but every reminder of the fact that she couldn't be there for her son was a fresh wound. She and her husband had decided that she would stay at home to look after the child for the first few years of his life, putting her own career on hold until he was old enough to start school. It was a sacrifice, but she wanted to be there. And it was one that she was prepared to make. It was a fine plan, but life had taken a different turn. Her husband had run off just after Angelo had been born. He had told her that he wasn't cut out to be a father, that he had too much life to live, and wasn't prepared to accept the changes that his son's arrival would require. Josie wasn't one for sentiment, and had written him out of their lives as soon as he had moved out. She had guessed that he was cheating on her, and, once he had confirmed it, her trust had died. She didn't try to change his mind. Instead, she cancelled the rent on their tiny flat in Taguig and moved in with her mother in Alabang. Her husband had been arrested shortly afterward on suspicion of drug offences. There had been insufficient evidence to charge him, and he had been released. His body had been found in Pasay 1 week later. He had been killed by one of the execution squads. A note on his body said, "I am a pusher. Don't follow." Her promotion had come shortly afterwards. It led to a small increase in Josie's salary, but the extra money had not so far made up for the increase in her workload. She left her mother's place at 6 in the morning, before Angelo was awake, and returned at 8 or 9 at night, long after he had gone to sleep. She would eat her dinner in his room, staring at him inside his crib as she ate the meal that her mother had prepared for her.
"What time will you be home tonight?"
"Late, I think."
"Josie, it can't be helped, Mama. There's been a murder."
"There's always a murder, and I have to interview the suspect."
"Don't you think you should see your son?"
"I want to," she said, her fingers tightening on the wheel as she tried to keep her tone civil. "But he needs me to make a living."
"He hasn't seen you for..."
"Look, it might not take long. It should be an easy one." This man was asleep in the same room as the victim. It looks like they'd both been drinking. "I'll speak to him. I doubt we'll be looking for anyone else. Maybe I can be home in time to put him to bed."
"Try, Anak. He misses you."
"I miss him too." She ended the call and swallowed down on a dry throat. It upset her to think of Angelo. She wanted to be with him, but she had to find the money to raise him too. It was a 15-minute drive from the guest house in Pasay to Police Station 4 in Pio del Pilar. The traffic was thick on Bautista Street, and Josie cranked the malfunctioning fan all the way to the max in an attempt to get some cool air into the cabin. She had a lot to do, and she just wanted to get started. Chapter 17. Police Station 4 was next to the crossroads where Vicente Cruz Street crossed Tuazon. Railway lines crossed the road to the left of the building, and there was a hissing and popping lattice of electrical cables and telephone wires overhead. The building itself was small, a white-painted two-story construction with the window frames and the balcony on the first floor all painted blue. It was surrounded by a low blue wall with taller white railings attached to it, and the entrance was shielded from the sun by a white awning with the words Sabisyong Makatotohanan, advertising the government radio initiative that was designed to teach the public how to prevent crime. Josie went under the awning and had the same thought that she always had. It was difficult to expect the public to take such measures seriously when there was so much municipal crime and corruption all around them. She waved good morning to Gloria, the woman behind the desk, who almost single-handedly ensured that the station ran efficiently, and went through into the back. Bruno Mendoza was in his office. She picked up her pace as she approached the open door, hoping that he might not see her.
"Josie!" he called out. "Could you come in for a moment?"
Mendoza was Josie's commanding officer. He was an inspector and had clawed his way up to that rank after a 20-year career distinguished only by a tenacious desire to advance himself and in spite of rumours of graft that had never been adequately proven. Everyone knew that he was also involved in the semi-sanctioned police death squads. No one would talk about it openly, but it was an open secret in the locker room.
Josie could guess at the membership of the team and knew that they met in the back room of Mendoza's favourite brothel to discuss their hits. The fact that he was so jolly made the fact of his involvement in something so bloody even more jarring. Mendoza was married, but he had a thing for her, an unfortunate attraction he regularly demonstrated with offers of dinner that she found increasingly difficult to turn down with grace. She stepped into the office. "What's up, Bruno?"
"You picked up a murder this morning."
She nodded.
"Bad luck."
"This isn't going to be a difficult one."
"Go on."
"Maid goes into a room, sees a man asleep under bed and a dead body in the bathroom. There's booze everywhere. Pretty obvious what happened."
"Drunken fight."
She nodded.
"He's English."
"Yes, sir. How do you know that?"
"I was in the yard when they brought him in."
"I'm going to interview him now. Is there anything else?"
"How's Angelo?"
"He's fine," she said, suppressing the usual shudder as he fumbled an attempt at intimacy.
"Are you taking him to the park tomorrow? They're saying the parade is going to be something special."
"I don't know," she said. "I haven't worked out what I'm doing yet."
"If you need to leave early, that would be okay."
He shuffled papers. "I'm going to be there. I'd love to meet him." "Let me think about it," she said, her skin prickling with discomfort.
"Fine," Mendoza said, grinning at her. "You do that."
"I'd better get in there."
"Let me know how it goes."
Josie said that she would, left the office and, grateful to be away from him, went to her desk to collect her notes and her voice recorder. Manuel Dalisai was waiting for her. "How was he?" she asked.
"Didn't say a word the whole time."
Dalisai had a paper bag of jelly beans and he offered one to Josie. She took it and put it into her mouth. "What do you make of him?"
"Cold," he said. "I saw him looking at me in the mirror. Dead eyes. Freak me out."
"I'm going to interview him now."
"Good luck with that."
She started away from the desk and then turned back. "I forgot to ask," she said. "How was the party?" Dalisai and his wife had been struggling to have a child for years, and in something of a miracle, given that Dalisai's wife was in her early 40s, a little girl had finally been born a year ago. They called her Mariel. Yesterday was her first birthday party. He smiled.
"It was good. I got there late, which didn't go down well. You remember that Shabu lab near Arayat?"
Josie remembered it well. Two trailers off the road to Magalang, east of Route 8, in the middle of nowhere. They had busted it 6 months earlier. "What about it?"
"We went back yesterday morning. They were using it again. Can you believe it?"
"The Chinese?"
He nodded. "The same crew. 8 of them this time. We only found out when they blew one of the labs up and the smoke was reported."
He reached down for a jelly bean.
"Anyway, by the time we'd wrapped that up and got back down to the city, I was 20 minutes late. I thought Mary Grace was going to kill me. But the party was so good, she forgot all about it. Lucky me, right?"
"I'm pleased it went well," Josie said. She reached into the open bag, snagged another candy and popped it into her mouth. She tapped the recorder with her finger and headed to the station's solitary interrogation room. Chapter 18. Josie looked through the peephole. The room beyond was sparsely furnished, with just a table and two chairs and a bench seat against the far wall. There was a single barred window, and a naked light bulb above the table flooded the space in harsh white light. The man was sitting at the table. His wrists were cuffed, and the chain was attached to a bracket on the table. Josie would have been nervous at the prospect of a solo interrogation when she first started, but she had done so many by now that it had become commonplace. And, in a case like this, it wasn't as if she would have to be inventive in order to secure a confession. That wasn't necessary. The interview would be almost entirely administrative. She unlocked the door and went inside. The man looked up.
"Hello, sir,"
she said. He gave a shallow nod. She looked at him. He had dark hair, a single comma of which uncurled over his forehead. She guessed he was in his mid-40s, with the usual lines and marks at the corners of his eyes, the edges of his mouth and nose. It was his eyes, though, that caught her attention. They were blue, icily cold, and dispassionate. Dalisai was right. He was cold. He looked up at her, and she had to swallow down a twist of apprehension.
"You're English?"
"Yes."
"Do you speak Filipino?"
"No."
"I can speak English a little. Tell me if you don't understand me."
"I understand you."
She took out her recorder and laid it on the table. "I'm going to use this," she said. He shrugged. "What is your name?"
"John Smith."
"I'm Officer Hernandez. I'm in charge of the investigation into what happened at the hotel."
Smith nodded but said nothing.
"Have you been offered a lawyer?"
"I don't want one."
"Are you sure?"
He nodded.
"Suspect confirms with a nod that he is not requesting a lawyer," she said for the benefit of the recording. "What do you do, Mr. Smith?"
"I'm a cook."
"And what are you doing in Manila? Holiday?"
"Something like that."
"I think you should talk to me about what happened."
The man looked straight at her but didn't speak.
"Mr. Smith?"
There was an expression of disconsolation on his face. She had interviewed many suspects over the course of her career, and their reactions could be easily categorized. Anger from those who knew they had been caught, slyness from those who thought that they were clever enough to talk their way free, confusion and despair from those who often turned out to be innocent. Smith's reaction was more akin to confusion, but there was more to it than that.
"Mr. Smith?"
"I can't remember what happened."
"What do you mean?"
"You can ask me whatever you like. I'll answer honestly as best I can."
"But..."
"There are long stretches of yesterday evening that I can't remember."
"So, tell me what you do remember. Let's start with that. Who was the girl?"
Smith sighed, splayed his fingers on the table and looked down at them. "Her name is Jessica Sanchez."
"How do you know her?"
"We were in a relationship, a long time ago. Years."
"So why were you with her last night?"
"She said that she wanted to speak to me. She said it was important."
"About?"
"I'd rather not say."
"You're not in a position to be selective with the questions you answer, Mr. Smith."
He paused and then decided to speak. "She said that she had a child, and that the child was mine."
"And what did she want? Money?"
"I don't know," he said.
"You didn't talk about it?"
"I don't remember what we talked about." She felt frustration. Smith's attitude was honest and confronting all at once. He wasn't doing himself any favors.
"What do you remember?"
"I remember getting to the hotel, checking in, going to my room. I went to Intramuros and Binondo, and then I went back to the hotel. I'd been out all day, so I was hot. I took a shower, listened to music for a little while, and then got changed and went out. I was hungry, so I bought kwek kwek from a street vendor, and then I went to the bar."
"Which bar?"
"The Lazy Lizard."
"In Poblacion?"
He nodded.
Jessica was there when I got there.
What time was this?
8.
And then?
We spoke.
About?
Small talk, nothing in particular. We hadn't seen each other for a long time, and there was a lot to catch up on.
But not the child?
I don't remember.
So you had a drink?
I don't know.
But you got drunk?
I don't remember ordering anything other than orange juice.
There were 2 empty bottles of vodka in your room, Mr. Smith. Cans of beer, too.
I know. I saw them. I don't remember buying them.
Are you an alcoholic, Mr. Smith?
He stared at her. Did you find my book?
Answer the question, please.
Yes, I am. I haven't had a drink for several years.
Until last night?
I can't remember.
You keep saying that, Mr. Smith. It's not helping you. Unless you tell me what happened so I can investigate it, I have to fill in the blanks from the evidence. If I do that, you're going to be charged with murder.
Smith paused.
Josie could see that he was considering what to say next.
When I was drinking, he said, I used to have blackouts. They don't affect everyone who drinks, and those who are affected get them in different ways. I used to get them very badly. I'd wake up in places with no idea how I'd got there. I'd wake up with women and I didn't know their names. It was embarrassing, and in the end it got to be frightening. It was one of the reasons that I stopped drinking.
You think the reason you can't remember what happened is because you blacked out?
I can't think of another reason.
I'll be honest with you. At some point between you meeting Miss Sanchez at 8 and the cleaner coming into your room this morning, she was killed. At the moment, Mr. Smith, it looks very bad for you. Unless you can give me another reason why she was found dead in the bathroom while you were asleep, I'm not going to have any choice other than to charge you. Can you do that?
I can't, he said. I don't know what to say. I can't remember.
Fine. Josie stood. He looked up at her. What will happen next? You'll be moved to a detention facility.
And then?
If you're charged, you'll go to trial. For a case like this, you won't have long to wait. A month, maybe? You'll need to find a lawyer. Do I get a phone call? Who would you like to call?
A friend. I need to tell him what's happened.
Yes, she said, of course. I'll speak to someone for you. She slid the chair back beneath the table. The interview had been disconcerting. The man's attitude confused her. He was open about his memory problems when most would never have admitted to them. He answered her questions with seeming honesty, and, above all, he was fatalistic. Josie found that unsettling. I'll arrange your call, she said. She opened the door, stepped outside, and locked it again. Yes, she thought, it was the fatalism that had perturbed her. It was, she realised, as if Smith couldn't remember what had happened, but that he was refusing to give himself the benefit of the doubt. It was almost as if a murder was something that he could consider himself doing. Chapter 19. Milton was taken from the interview room to a smaller room where he was photographed and had his fingerprints taken. The officer asked him to undress, and then he was photographed again. They took swabs from his mouth, scraped out the material from beneath his nails, and then took blood. Milton cooperated without complaint, but it was an intensely uncomfortable experience for a man who had been so used to sliding beneath the surface of things. The last time he had been arrested, the Russian Secret Service had located him and sent an agent to the Texan jail where he was being held in order to bail him out. There were people who would have given a lot to know where he was now, especially when he was so compromised. He was travelling under false papers, but that was no guarantee that his anonymity would be maintained.
His legal predicament was bad enough, but beyond that, he was vulnerable in so many other ways. They went through his possessions. They took his fake passport, his wallet, the Ronson lighter that his father had given him, his cigarettes, and the handful of loose change that he had collected in his pockets. He did not protest, and, once the formalities of his booking were completed, he was led down into the basement of the building to a holding cell. It was a 20x20 space with a set of substantial iron bars that divided the room into two. Two cameras had been fixed to the ceiling, their motors buzzing as they panned left and right to take in all of the room. Milton looked through the bars at the collection of men staring back at him. The cage was full to overflowing, with the bench seats around the sides all taken, and another 10 or so milling around in the centre. The occupants glared with baleful malevolence as his cuffs were removed. There were just two officers down here, the man who had brought him down from the custody suite, and the officer who was in the basement to watch the detainees. Both men were armed, but neither moved with the caution that would have been prudent. They would have been much more careful if they had an inkling of Milton's past and the things of which he was capable. The custody officer unlocked and opened the cage door. Milton saw the butt of his pistol jutting out from his holster and knew how easy it would be to relieve him of the weapon. He felt the prickle of adrenaline, the itch in his palms, but he drew in a breath and allowed the moment to pass. This was not the time to make an attempt at leaving. Even if he was able to disarm the two officers, there was a good chance his actions would bring unwelcome attention. The men in the cell would likely make a noise, and then there was the matter of the two cameras overhead. He was in the basement of a police building. If he was compromised, he would have to fight his way out, through the ground floor, and then out onto the street. He might make it, but he didn't like the odds. And he would have to kill. He wasn't prepared to do that. Chapter 20. Milton tried to gauge the time as best he could, but it was dark in the basement and there was no window where he could assess the passage of time. Police officers came and went, delivering new suspects to be detained and taking others away again. But no one came for him. He waited for the chance to make his phone call, deciding that he would contact Hicks, but it seemed as if he had been forgotten. When he tried to speak to one of the guards to remind him that he was still waiting, the man shrugged and pretended that he didn't understand English. There was no point in pushing it. Milton sat down to wait it out. Milton guessed it was another 2 hours before they came for him.
"Hey," the guard said, "English, come here."
Milton stood and came to the door of the cell. "Phone call," he said, extending his thumb and little finger and putting them to his mouth and ear.
"Hands."
The guard opened the slot at waist height and told Milton to slide his hands through so that he could cuff him. Milton did as he was told and didn't react as the cuffs bit into the skin around his wrists. He withdrew his hands and stepped back as the door was pushed back.
"Out."
Milton stepped out of the cell.
"Phone call," Milton said. "No phone call," the man grunted.
"Where am I going?"
"Transfer," he said with an unpleasant smirk.
"To where?"
"Bilibid."
"What's that?"
"Prison."
"In Manila?"
"Move."
The guard took out his baton and used it to prod Milton in the back. He walked on, the guard jabbing him between the shoulders to ensure that he kept going. They passed through two heavy doors and then out of the building through an exit into a yard. There was a Toyota Hiace parked alongside the building. It was painted white, with the livery of the National Police added in blue and red. The rear doors were open, offering access into a compartment that was kept separate from the driver and his passenger by a wire mesh cage. The guard prodded Milton in the back once again and, still biting his tongue, he reached for the door frame with his cuffed hands and pulled himself inside. The doors were slammed shut. The vehicle was not air-conditioned, and the rear wasn't ventilated. The temperature inside the cage must have been more than 100 degrees. There were bench seats on either side of the vehicle, and Milton lowered himself onto one of them and waited for the driver and another guard to get into the front. The driver started the engine and, with a creak from its suspension, the Hiace pulled out of the jail compound and onto the road outside. The bench seat was uncomfortable. It was directly over the wheel arch and it vibrated unpleasantly every time the van bounced over uneven stretches of road. The two men in the front of the van spoke in Filipino. Milton was unable to understand their discussion and quickly tuned it out. He tried to assess his situation. He located west by looking for the sun. It was in the afternoon, and he was able to judge that they were headed in a generally southerly direction. They passed signs for Makati and Taguig and ignored the turnoff that was marked for the airport. He estimated that they had been travelling for around 90 minutes at a speed of around 60 miles an hour. Milton did not know the geography of the island, but, based on his assumptions, he suspected that they were around 90 miles to the south of the capital. They turned off the main road at Alabang. They continued, the road becoming smaller and narrower as it passed through a series of villages and hamlets. Vegetation thronged on either side and, as Milton turned his head to glance at a clutch of children watching them go by, he caught sight of a road sign. It was in English and read, Insular Prison Road. They continued for another 5 minutes, eventually slowing and pulling onto a driveway that terminated at a large iron gate. There was a checkpoint next to the gate, and the driver wound down his window so that he could speak with the guard. The guard stepped out of the hut, put his hands to the window and looked in at Milton. He went back to the driver, exchanged a curt word, and then opened the gate. The van drove through. Milton looked ahead through the windshield. They were approaching a large white building with two towers on either side. The parapet atop the walls had been crenellated, and a vinyl banner had been strung up above the entrance. The banner contained a mixture of English and Filipino, but Milton was able to see Welcome, and beneath that, New Bilibid Prison. They drove into the main prison compound. Milton looked out and saw tall brick walls that were topped with razor wire with elevated guard posts every 100 feet or so. He saw armed guards in the posts and powerful-looking spotlights. Vast palm trees swayed outside the walls, their fronds 60 and 70 feet above the ground. The buildings were simple, whitewashed and substantial. The van followed the road around to an admissions area and, as they slowed, Milton was able to catch a glance through another gate into a courtyard, where he saw hundreds of men. They milled about in groups. Some sat on the ground, while others ran or worked out. Milton saw a man in a pair of bright blue shorts lying on an improvised weight bench. He was lifting an iron bar that had been fitted to two cylinders of concrete. The van stopped by an open entrance. Two armed guards opened the doors of the van and indicated that Milton should step down. Harsh, bright light streamed into the back of the Hiace, and Milton blinked into it as he descended. One of the guards held a pair of leg irons, and he bent and closed the shackles around Milton's ankles. They were attached to a chain with just enough play to allow Milton to take a step. A second chain was attached to his handcuffs and, with Milton now duly trussed up, the guard indicated that Milton should go through the archway and into the darkened space beyond. Chapter 21. Milton paid close attention as he shuffled through the arch and into a building beyond it. They were still outside the main prison compound, close enough to the courtyard that he had seen earlier to hear the sound of a basketball bouncing against the ground and the clamour of dozens of voices. Every forward step took him farther away from his liberty, but he was already beyond the point where he could have done anything to go back. He was shackled, and the guards were armed. What was he going to do? The new building was evidently dedicated to the processing of new inmates. Papers were handed over to a man sitting behind a desk. He looked up to regard Milton, and, with a disdainful flick of his hand, he indicated that Milton should continue into the gloomy room beyond. Milton was shoved in the back and nearly tripped, the chain clanking as it went taut and then loose once more. The guards followed close behind him as he emerged into a wide space. There was a long table with a stack of prison uniforms wrapped in plastic sheaths. In the middle of the room was a pile of shoes, each pair tied together by the laces. There was a mirror on the wall and, opposite it, a coiled fire hose with a dripping nozzle. He was delivered into the custody of two guards. They were also armed, with pistols holstered on their belts. One of the guards stepped around and unlocked the cuffs that secured Milton's arms and legs. The man removed them, the chains ringing against each other, and Milton took the opportunity to massage his wrists. The nearest guard looked at him with unmasked contempt.
"Take off clothes!"
Milton knew that he had little choice other than to comply. He undid the buttons of his shirt and took it off. He took off his trousers and underwear and stood his ground as he was searched. The guard paused, noting the tattoos that covered Milton's body and, perhaps unnerved by his poise and lack of fear. He told Milton to spread his legs and then bend over and, moving with practiced ease, satisfied himself that he was not transporting contraband. Milton had seen the dripping hose and knew what was coming next. The guard pointed.
"Against wall."
Milton crossed the room. The floor was sodden and the paint had been scoured off the wall. The guard took the hose, aimed it squarely at him and cranked the tap. A torrent of freezing cold water rushed out. It pummeled Milton in the chest, driving the air from his lungs and shocking him with the sudden drop in temperature. Milton clenched his jaw, unwilling to give the guards the pleasure of seeing his discomfort. They laughed anyway, the guard with the hose training it down at his genitals and then up to his face. Milton closed his eyes and turned away so that the jet thrashed against the side of his head. The tap was turned and the flow stopped. Milton stood where he was as the water sluiced off his body. His skin tingled. The guard assessed Milton's size, selected a uniform from the pile and tossed it down onto the floor in front of him.
"Dress."
The uniform was orange. Milton tore the pack open and took out the two items inside, a pair of trousers and a short-sleeved shirt. They were made from rough denim, and they scratched his damp skin as he put them on. The guard looked at Milton's boots, shared a joke with his comrades, and put them to one side. Milton guessed that he wouldn't see them again. The guard took a pair of sneakers from the pile and tossed them over. They were old, with a hole in the upper and cracks in the tread. Milton put them on. They were a little small, but not unbearably so. He decided that he would make do rather than invite them to give him a pair that was even more uncomfortable. There were other items on the table, and Milton was instructed to take one of each. He collected a cotton blanket, a threadbare sleeping mat of woven pandan, and a plate and mug made out of cheap, pliable tin. The guard grabbed him by the shoulder and shoved.
"This way."
Chapter 22. The guards led Milton deeper into the prison. They passed through the outer door of the administration building and followed a dim corridor that cut directly down the centre of the building beyond. There were barred partitions at regular intervals. The guards were able to open these with the keys on their belt. Milton looked left and right. Everything he saw reminded him that his liberty had been removed. The caged doors through which they progressed. The barred doors on either side, secured with thick sliding bolts. The guards in their khaki uniforms and caps, with holstered pistols and billy clubs that hung on fabric loops from their belts. They reached a third barrier and, rather than unlock it, this time the guards were required to speak into an intercom. Milton glanced up and saw a camera, its unblinking black eye staring down at him. There was a short conversation, unintelligible to him apart from the mention of the name Smith. And then an electronic buzz as the gate was unlocked. The guard opened it, stepped to the side, and indicated that Milton should make his way through. This new room looked to be the final one before the start of the main compound. A guard, wearing the same uniform, was positioned behind a lectern that bore a clipboard replete with papers. Milton was put in mind of a maitre d' standing station outside a restaurant, although the comparison was grotesque in the circumstances. The man collected the transfer papers from the guard and assumed custody of Milton. He looked at the papers and typed details into the computer terminal that was on a small desk next to the lectern. Once he was finished, he gestured that the guard should bring Milton around to him. He took Milton's right hand, pressing his fingerprints against an ink pad, and then recorded the impressions on a slip of card that would accompany his details in a filing cabinet somewhere within the prison's bureaucracy. He was moved to the wall and given a black strip of card that he held up to his chest. It bore a series of numbers and a letter. 13653S.
That is your name, not Smith. You are 13653, understand?
I understand, he said. The guard nodded behind him to a small gate that had been opened from the inside. Milton went through. A guard was waiting for Milton on the other side of the gate. He was obese, his belly straining against the buttons of his khaki shirt. His skin was slick with sweat. There were damp crescents beneath his armpits, a sheen on his face, and droplets caught in the hairs of his moustache.
"Welcome to New Bilibid, 13653."
The man laughed at that, as if he considered it to be a particularly choice joke.
"Where are you from?"
"London."
"And you are a murderer?"
It wasn't a question. It was a statement. Milton did not respond.
"You murdered a woman. Better hope that stays secret."
The corridor was dark, and it took Milton a moment for his eyes to adjust. There were other men here. A guard, his hand on the butt of his pistol, guided an orange-clad teenager into an adjoining room. Another inmate pushed a trolley that carried a bucket and mop and other cleaning implements. Another prisoner was on his knees, bent close to the floor so that he could scrub it with soapy water and a brush. The man, Milton saw that he was little more than a boy, sprang to his feet and stood ramrod straight as Milton and the guard approached.
"You are used to nice things in London. Clean clothes, a comfortable bed, good food and drink, yes?"
Milton kept walking. The man turned his head and spat at the wall.
"You have nothing like that here. It is dirty. It smells, and the men you will be kept with will kill you if you let them."
They passed a group of four inmates soon after, and, at a gesture from the guard, they dropped to their haunches and pressed themselves with their backs against the wall and their heads bent in a token of their civility.
"You will have a trial soon, and then, when you have been convicted, you will be returned here for your sentence. If you are lucky, you will go to the room where we have the injections. You should pray for that sentence. Live here, if that is what you get, will be bad in comparison."
They reached the door at the end of the corridor. The guard rapped his knuckles against it and then stepped back as it was unlocked and opened. Milton blinked as he was assailed by bright light. He had expected that his cell would be in the main building, but it was not. Instead, the corridor opened onto a wide plaza with a network of wire mesh fencing that split it into separate sections. The ground underfoot was bare, the earth cooked in the sun until it was as hard as asphalt. The guard led Milton to a building marked with a notice as Building Number 1. It was a long building, several stories tall and oblong in shape. The entrance was halfway down the long flank, and as they walked between two wire mesh fences to reach it, Milton counted 20 windows. Each was small and dingy, bars bisecting the dark apertures, and a further screen of mesh increasing the security and, Milton guessed, reducing the light that was allowed to filter inside. He heard a loud metallic rattle and the noise of barked orders, and, as he turned back into the yard, he saw a group of 50 or 60 inmates being herded deeper into the compound. They were shackled together, each man fitted with leg irons, and then chained to the men in front and behind. They wore faded orange shorts and were shirtless, their bodies exposed to the scouring sun. Their heads were shaved, and their skin was slick with sweat. The formation was shepherded by a team of guards, their batons drawn so that they could be flicked out to encourage stragglers to greater effort and dissuade those who might consider the possibility of dissent.
"You see them," the guard said. "They are castigados. They have broken prison rules. Perhaps they have smuggled contraband, or they have gambled, tried to escape, or committed sodomy. They are punished."
"What kind of punishment?"
"Hard labor. They break rocks. They work in the sun until they collapse, and then they are returned to isolation. They do it again until they agree that the rules must be obeyed. Understand?"
"I do," Milton said. The guards brought the phalanx to a halt and circulated among the men, inspecting them. One of the prisoners refused to respond to a comment from the guard standing before him. The guard pulled his baton from his belt and struck the man on the shins with a downward backhand slash. The prisoner looked up and spat at the guard's feet. The guard called out, and two of his colleagues hurried to his side, their own clubs drawn. The three men struck the prisoner again and again, their blows landing on his legs and torso and against his shoulders and arms as he tried to protect his head. The man fell to his knees, but his weakness seemed only to provoke his attackers to greater effort, and they continued the beating until he was face down in the dust, blood running freely from a deep cut to his scalp.
"Inside," the guard said to Milton.
The entrance to building number one was a broad opening in the wall. There were two doors, barriers that could be slid back on runners that were fitted into the concrete. The first door was made of two pieces of solid steel, and the second comprised two rows of iron bars. They had both been pushed halfway open to allow access. There was a guard slumped in a plastic chair in front of the doors. He glared sullenly at Milton as he was pushed inside. The entrance led into a hexagonal space from which a number of corridors trailed away. There was a flight of stairs that led up to the first floor, and, running directly to the left and right, was a corridor that Milton assumed must have been the main means of accessing the cells. It was blocked in both directions by iron doors that were secured with padlocks. There was a table just inside the gloom, at which sat two guards. They were engaged in a board game that Milton did not recognise, and neither paid him any heed as the guard nudged him toward the door on his right. It was unlocked, and Milton was led inside. The corridor was constructed from bare concrete blocks. It opened out into a wide lobby that had been arranged around a flight of stairs. Milton looked up. The building was open, and the stairs ascended to the fourth floor high above. Each floor had a landing, and each landing offered access to cells. Milton looked at the cells on the ground floor. There were doors on either side of him, each made from solid metal bars that were also covered in wire mesh. There was an open antechamber where another group of guards was waiting. There was a brief conversation, and one of the men got up from his plastic picnic chair and took a large bunch of keys from a hook on the wall. He led the way to the stairs and then climbed them to the second floor. Milton was shoved along the landing until he reached a cell on the right-hand side. The guard unlocked the door and pulled it open. The man stepped aside. Milton didn't resist. He felt a hard shove in his back and stumbled into the darkness beyond.
Chapter 23. Milton's cell was tiny. It was 2 meters deep and 1.5 meters wide, and was empty except for a toilet bowl that was fixed to the wall in the far right-hand corner, shielded from view by a waist-high wall made of cement blocks. Water was provided from a tap to the left of the toilet. It dripped, and a slimy puddle had formed beneath it. There was no furniture within the cell. There was just the cement floor, the cement ceiling, and the cement block walls. There was a single window. It was high in the wall, with a sill at shoulder height. Milton went over to it. It was bisected with a lattice of sturdy bars, with the same mesh screwed down over it on the outside wall. Milton looked out through the mesh. He could see a row of whitewashed buildings with guards gathering between them. The wall of the compound was visible beyond the buildings and, looming above everything, there was a guard tower with a searchlight and a machine gun pointing over the parapet. The sun was sinking and, as it moved by degrees to the west, the angle opened so that the brightness could seep inside. Milton realized that he was carrying his bed beneath his arm. He spread out the bedroll on the floor next to the wall. It was thin and stained, and as he lowered himself down onto it, he knew that he was going to have a difficult time sleeping. The light was better now, and he could make out more detail. The walls had been whitewashed at some point in the distant past, and since then they had grown dirty and smeared. Some of the stains were from bedbugs and cockroaches that had been crushed against the abrasive surface. There were inscriptions where names and messages had been scratched into the brick. Bayani, Rodel, Cyan. Milton couldn't read the messages, but he could guess at the sentiment. There were downward scratches in groups of six, the seventh mark slashing diagonally across them to commemorate the passing of another week. Other marks were different. There were religious inscriptions. Someone had scratched an image of a woman. There was a patch of wall above Milton's head where a reddish stain had been left. There was a rough circular patch and then four vertical stripes. Milton reached up his hand and laid it over the stain, realizing as he did that it was a bloody palm print. Milton thought of the man he had seen outside and the beating that he had taken. He was uneasy. He was different from all the other prisoners that he had seen, and he knew that would mark him out for special attention from them and from the guards. And he was accused of murdering a woman. That, too, would play badly for him. Milton lay flat. His left shoulder was against the wall, and he was able to reach out with his right hand and touch the opposite wall. It was a tiny room, but at least it was just him. At least for now. He closed his eyes and tried to remember back to his training in the regiment. They had put him in smaller spaces than this, kept him there for hours as they tried to approximate what might happen if he was ever captured by the enemy. That had been unpleasant, but it was very different. He had known, even if he didn't know how long it would take, that the door to his cell would eventually be opened and he would be allowed to leave. He would be able to get into his car and drive into Hereford and have a drink with the other men in the regiment. This was different. He knew that he was going to have to keep a low profile if he wanted to stay alive. Chapter 24. Josie busied herself with her usual duties for the rest of the day. She had a backlog of 3 murders that had been solved, but still needed to have the paperwork completed. She checked the evidence that had been prepared for a forthcoming trial, another murder, and called the pathology unit to check whether they were going to autopsy the woman from this morning. They said that it wasn't planned. Josie thought about that and, on a whim, asked them to conduct one anyway. The clerk grumbled that they were busy, but that it would be ready in the next couple of days. She told him she wanted it done faster than that, and then she rang off. The clock ticked around to 6, and she decided that she had had enough for the day.
She was tired, and she wanted to see Angelo before he went to bed. Her phone rang as she was getting ready to leave. She thought about answering it, but decided to let it go to voicemail. She closed down her computer, put the evidence for the trial in her bag, and, careful to avoid Mendoza, left the station. She went around to the back, slid into her car, and cranked the air conditioning all the way to the maximum. She put the car into gear and set off. On impulse, she decided to make a quick stop on the way home. Instead of going south to Alabang, she turned to the east and drove to Poblacion. The Lizard Lounge was a nasty-looking dive, fitted with a series of crude neon signs designed to lure tourists inside. Josie parked her car beneath a yellow pint pot with beer in electric blue and white froth that blinked on and off. She got out, passed through the doors, and went inside. She went to the bar and attracted the attention of the barman. He came over to her. He was in his mid-30s, with a head of long, greasy hair and a sleeve of bad tattoos on his arm.
"What do you want?"
She laid her badge on the bar.
"I'm Officer Hernandez."
The man shifted nervously.
"What do you want?"
he said again.
"The owner."
"That's me,"
he said. She regarded him dubiously.
"Really?" "This is my place," he said again. "What do you want?"
"Last night," she said, "were you working?"
"Yes, I work every night."
"There was an Englishman in here. Do you remember?"
"Don't know," he said with a shrug. "I had a few in last night. The holiday tomorrow. Gonna be busy all week."
Josie took out the mugshot of Smith that had been at the station. She laid it on the bar.
"This is him. Have a look. He was here. Try to remember."
The man made the pretense of examining the mugshot.
"I don't know. Like I say, there were a lot of people here last night. I can't remember everyone."
"He met a woman here. It would have been around 8. Have a look again, please, sir."
The man did as he was told, screwing up his face in an approximation of concentration. He shook his head and slid the photograph back over the bar.
"No," he said. "I don't remember him."
Josie watched him. People reacted in different ways when they were spoken to by the police, and nervousness was not unusual. Working in a bar meant that he probably had secrets that he would much rather stayed secret. Perhaps he had arrangements with local pimps, or he was paying protection money to underworld enforcers, or he knew that drug pushers operated from his premises, and he worried that they might make him a target for the president's crackdown. Whatever it was, he was anxious.
"That's fine," she said. "Thanks for looking."
The man shrugged.
"Anything else?"
"Yes, actually there is."
She pointed up at the glossy lens of the CCTV camera on the wall above the till.
"I'd like to have a look at the footage from last night."
The request flustered the man.
"Really?
Is that a problem?"
"There's no problem," he said, trying to recover. "It's fine. I just need to make sure it was running."
"Could I have a look now?"
He shuffled.
"No," he said. I mean, yes, you could, but the video is in the storeroom, and I just need to make sure it's okay to go in. We've just had a delivery."
He was stalling. Josie was sure now that he was hiding something.
"I'm sure I'll be fine," she said.
The bar was hinged at the end so that a section could be raised to gain access. She reached for it and started to push it up.
"Josie!"
She stopped, returned the hatch to its lower position and turned. Bruno Mendoza was behind her. He was smiling warmly.
"Hello, sir,"
she said.
"What are you doing?"
"Following up on the murder this morning."